I want to reassure you that your pastor search committee, and raise your hands if you're on the pastor search committee. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I want to assure you that we have been working hard to find the perfect pastor for our church. Toward that end, I found on the internet the following list of qualifications for our perfect pastor. 1. Our perfect pastor preaches exactly 15 minutes. He condemns sin roundly, but he never hurts anyone's feelings. He works from 8 a.m. till midnight and is also the church janitor. The perfect pastor makes $400 a week, wears good clothes, drives a nice car, but not too nice, buys good books, and donates $300 a week to the church. He's 29 years old and has 40 years of experience. The perfect pastor has a burning desire to work with teenagers, and he spends most of his time with the senior citizens. He smiles all the time with a straight face because he has a sense of humor that keeps him seriously dedicated to our church. He makes 15 home visits a day, but he's always in the office available when you need him. Our perfect pastor never misses the meeting of any church organization, and he's always busy evangelizing the unchurched and the unsaved. Now, if your pastor does not measure up, simply send this notice to 6 other churches that are tired of their pastor too. Then bundle up your pastor and send him to the church at the top of the list. If everyone cooperates in 1 week, you will receive 1,643 pastors. One of them is bound to be perfect. And as a warning, have faith in this letter. One church broke the chain and got its old pastor back in less than 3 months. In all seriousness, though, we did find a list of qualifications for our new pastor in the New Testament. Paul's first letter to Timothy, chapter 3, verses 1 to 7, has such a list of qualifications, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. 1 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 7. Here is a trustworthy saying. If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, he desires a noble task. Now the overseer must be above reproach, the husband of but one wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him with proper respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Remember that Paul, the at this point aging but very experienced missionary, is writing this letter back to his protege, Timothy, who he has left in charge of the churches in Ephesus, a major city in the world at that time. He's left Timothy in charge to care for and lead for those churches and help them as they grow and establish new churches. And since Paul calls Timothy in chapter 1, verse 2, my true son in the faith, that makes a lot of people think that he probably led Timothy to faith in Jesus Christ. At some point, Paul saw great potential in Timothy and took him on. He wanted to be his mentor in the pastoral ministry. Now, remember that back in those days, if you wanted to become a doctor, you didn't go to medical school. There was no such thing. You became the protege, the assistant to a doctor. And you went wherever he did, you helped him do whatever he did, and he taught you how to be a doctor along the way. Likewise, if you wanted to be a pastor, you didn't go to seminary and get a degree. You became the protege of an experienced pastor, and you went with him and did the things that he did, and he told you how to do the right things in the right ways. Well, when Paul writes this letter, he's on one of his missionary journeys, and he writes this back to Timothy with various kinds of wisdom that he needs for dealing with the churches and leading the churches in Ephesus. And this passage, this particular passage, talks to Timothy about these are the things you should look for in pastors of the churches that you are looking over, that you're overseeing. Now, we use the word pastor, but the word here is actually overseer, one who sees over something or somebody. The meaning is very much like shepherd. Just like a shepherd watches over a flock of sheep to guide them and protect them and get them fed, an overseer in a church sense is like a shepherd. He watches over the church, over the family of God, and feeds them and helps them grow. In modern language, we say pastor. It means the same thing. The words bishop and elder are sometimes substituted in this passage. But they're also means the same thing as pastor in various situations. Now, the fact that Paul had to write anything at all on the qualifications of pastors back to Timothy tells you something. That tells you something. It tells you that those early Christian churches had already had problems with their pastors. They didn't turn out to be that great. They had problems. And so Paul is writing back to Timothy with this list of qualifications, so perhaps we can prevent some of the problems we've already heard about in other churches. Pastors, apparently, some of them, were unable to do the job that they were called to do in various churches back then, and some of them made a big mess of the churches that they were supposed to be caring for. So Paul sends Timothy this list to reduce the chances that that kind of thing will happen anymore. And in a sense, you would think, reading between the lines, Paul is warning Timothy, don't just pick anybody to be a pastor. You have to have very high standards, and here are some of them. Well, one thing about human nature that I've learned is that anytime you see someone warning about a certain thing to people, warning people about a certain thing, or writing rules for human behavior, you can be sure they're doing that because of something bad that previously happened. They're trying to prevent it from happening again, so they make a rule. Don't do this. Don't do that. But do it this way. So if you see a tag sewn into your shirt, and if the tag says, remove shirt before ironing, you know that somebody somewhere tried to iron that shirt while they were wearing it. Okay, so silly, but someone did it. So we're going to have to put a warning in here before they sue us. You didn't tell me not to iron my shirt while I was wearing it. And one I've appreciated since I never saw it anywhere but in New Hampshire, if you pull up to a traffic light, and it's red, and you stop, and you look up there, and there's a sign that says, no left turn on red arrow. I went, what? You can't turn left on a red arrow. Everybody knows that. But apparently, people turn left on red arrows right into traffic and cause accidents. So whenever you see rules like that, or like the ones Paul puts here, it's because something bad happened, and they're trying to prevent it from happening again with those rules. So Paul wants Timothy to apply these 14 things that he says, to his choice of pastors for these little churches, these new little churches in Ephesus. Every one of them is mentioned because at least one bad thing happened. And so you can figure out, what was the bad thing that happened? Well, read what it says. Shall not be given to much wine. Okay, well, we can figure out what happened there. Don't have to have anyone tell us. Now remember that the people that Timothy is going to pick from, or they're just normal people. They haven't been to seminary. They don't have a degree in anything. But someone has to be the pastor of the church, and this is what he's supposed to be looking for. They were just ordinary men being mentored by somebody. Possibly Timothy was their mentor, so they could learn how to be the pastor of a church. The first qualification that Paul tells Timothy about an overseer or a pastor is that he should be above reproach. That's probably the biggest one, because it covers so much ground. Above reproach means that basically you shouldn't choose somebody as a pastor who has been or could be accused of some illegal or immoral behavior either before or while they're being the pastor. No church should have to be worried constantly that their pastor might be up to no good when they're out and about. That's why in modern times, including our committee, that we perform criminal and financial background checks, because you'd be surprised what Some pastors have in their backgrounds. If a man has an arrest for DUI or theft or anything else, that would be a big red flag for a committee or a church. And it's something we want to look into. It's not an automatic disqualifier because he did something in the past. In fact, it may be part of his testimony. He may say that, you know, before I came to Christ, I was hell on wheels, and I did this, and I was arrested for that, and, you know, the Lord saved me. Okay, that's a lot different. You know, we find that out in a background check. That's a lot different than, yeah, last week I was arrested for DUI and child abuse. Okay, a little bit of a problem for being our pastor. So it depends on the circumstances. Was the person even a Christian at the time that this happened? Because that makes a big difference. How long ago did it happen? Was it last month, or was it 22 years ago? I don't know. If a man is in the least bit a shady character, he shouldn't be a pastor until his behavior and his reputation are tested and improved over time, so that people who look at him now could say, he's above reproach, I would trust him. But there are some people you can't say that about yet, because there are some problems that need to be dealt with. The second qualification he lists is, literally it's translated, if you just look at the Greek, it says a one-woman man. And that gets translated in different ways, husband of one wife. You can go at it several different ways, but in Greek it's a one-woman man. He's a one-woman man. There are some pretty fierce debates. If you've never heard them, I'll tell you right now. There are some pretty fierce debates among Christians about what this means to us today in terms of looking for a pastor. But there is room, because he just said a one-woman man. He didn't go into any detail. I would have raised my hand at the time, if there was such a way to raise my hand, because it was a letter. But if it was in a class, I would have said, excuse me, Paul, and I would have asked some questions. But he didn't do that, so there's a little wiggle room in there what he really means. For instance, one way to understand it is that the pastor must never have been divorced. That's the way some churches understand this. Others would add, not only shouldn't he have been divorced, he has to be married. You can't call a pastor who's single, because it says he's a one-woman man. So he has to have a woman. So he has to be married. Others would go a different way, and they would say that back in the time that this was written, the Jews practiced polygamy. For various reasons. One, if you remember in the Old Testament, if a man died and left his wife a widow, if he had a brother, he was supposed to marry her and take her into his household, because otherwise she's going to be starving to death without anybody to take care of her. And so a man would have his original wife, and he would have his brother's wife. His brother's now dead, and God forbid that would happen more than once. He might have two or three wives. But they also practiced polygamy as the way we would think of it, like maybe the Mormons did in the 19th century, or how they still do sometimes in secret, or the Muslims. So to the Jews, polygamy was okay at this time. The Romans, oddly enough, considering how much corruption and there was in their government among their Caesars and their leaders and stuff, the Romans thought polygamy was disgusting. And they would never do it, except they did let the Jews do it within the confines of the Roman Empire, because that was just the Jews. They let them do their thing. So it is possible that Paul is referring here to polygamy, is that if you're going to have a man who's going to be a pastor of a Christian church, he can't have multiple wives. Now, obviously, today, we have to choose. Was he talking about polygamy? Was he talking about divorce? Or was he talking about both? Okay, you can have your opinion, you're welcome to it, but he doesn't say real clearly. He just says one woman man. But obviously, in today's world, a pastor who has been divorced would be a hard sell to most churches if they knew that he had been divorced. But other churches might be more forgiving and accepting of a divorced pastor if the divorce wasn't his fault, she divorced him. Or if it happened a long, long time ago, and he's learned his lesson from that. And if his wife had been unfaithful. Some churches would then say, okay, well, having a divorce is not good, but we're not going to eliminate you from consideration. The third qualification that Paul mentions is being temperate. Temperate. Being temperate means not being extreme. Personality-wise, it means being stable, calm, and cool-headed. We can all appreciate that. Number four is self-controlled. No one wants a pastor who's the kind of guy who goes to his son's baseball, Little League baseball game, and he spends the whole game yelling at the umpires and the coaches and the other kids' parents and gets, you know, no one wants a pastor like that. That's not self-controlled. No one should have a pastor whose mouth is out of control and with mean and vulgar comments. No pastor should be known for breaking things and punching walls if he doesn't get his way. That's not self-controlled. The fifth qualification is respectable. The pastor should look, act, and speak like a respected leader of the community, whatever community that is, because that's what he's supposed to be. That's what he's supposed to be. So he should be respectable. You know, back in the colonies, in the 1600s and 1700s, and in Europe in the 1600s and 1700s, pastors were one of the most respected members of society. It's hard to believe today because pastors aren't, but back then they were one of the most respectable people in the community. Back then, parents who had real high expectations for their sons, they would steer them toward being a doctor or a lawyer or a pastor, because those were the three most respectable careers you could be in those days. Not anymore. Lawyers either. Or doctors after COVID. Yeah, we're not too thrilled with them either. Number six, hospitable. Hospitable. A pastor should be the kind of person who helps people feel welcome, safe, and comfortable. People shouldn't always be on edge around a pastor. He should be able to make them feel comfortable. And pastors should be known for the quality of their hospitality when they have people in their home, which they should. Seventh qualification is able to teach. And this is the very core of the pastor's responsibility. It's not the only thing, but it's very core for a pastor. It includes teaching of the Word of God from the pulpit, from a classroom, or even in just one-on-one conversations and counseling. There are a lot of fine Christian men and women who have many, many excellent qualities who just don't have the knack of teaching. That's just it, okay? That's all. That's just something they can't do. They can be deacons. They could be elders. They could just be plain great Christians. But if they can't teach, then they shouldn't be pastors. There's no shame in that. Eight is, you can translate it several different ways. The literal translation is a little tough. But eight is not given to drunkenness or not addicted to much wine. Now you start thinking, okay, why did they have to ask? Okay, they had to put that down because that was a problem. Paul had really already covered that issue when he said temperate, self-controlled, and respectable. If you're constantly getting drunk, you're not going to be any of those three things. And he already listed those. But so why did he list it again? Because it was that big of a problem that some of their pastors had been alcoholics, or they abused alcohol, and it just ruined their church, just like it would today. There's no requirement in the New Testament or anywhere else that pastors have to totally abstain from all alcohol ever. But they can't be known for getting drunk, driving under the influence, getting into fights at bars and other places. You don't want to have to go get your pastor at the bar because the police called you. That's not good. And pastors can't get drunk and say the stupid, hurtful things that people who are drunk say. It just ruins his witness and his ministry. So if Paul had to mention this, it had to be a problem, especially since he already said temperate, self-controlled, and respectable. Number nine is not violent, but gentle. Now you try to imagine a pastor who gets into fights is going to be out of a problem. Or a pastor who slaps his wife or children around violently is going to be a problem. He's going to destroy his church and his own example and his own ministry. and is going to cause damage to God's kingdom. Paul must have known examples of that too, and if I had time, I would tell you a few police stories about calls we had to churches, but I won't. I don't have time. The tenth requirement is not quarrelsome. Not quarrelsome. Pastors have to sometimes correct sin in people who don't want to have the sin corrected in them. Not going to be popular. Don't want to hear it. Sometimes they have to debate with someone who's teaching false doctrines and leading people astray. Sometimes pastors have to stand up in public and tell the people where they're wrong. Like John the Baptist stood up and told Herod Antipas that it was immoral for him to have Herodias as his wife. Herodias had been his brother's wife, and he had an affair with her and then stole her away and married her. The Romans, I tell you. But that's, none of that is quarrelsome. Quarrelsome is something else. Quarrelsome means you have a habit of stirring up anger and resentment by the way you say things. You're looking for a fight verbally. That's quarrelsome. It's the opposite, really, of being honest, direct, and unapologetic about the things you have to say. Quarrelsome describes being mean and unnecessarily disruptive when you talk. Pastors not only have to say the right things, they have to be wise enough to say the right things in the right ways at the right time. Number 11 is not a lover of money. Pastors have to provide for their families. That's not the same as a love for money. They have to earn some money to support their families like the rest of us. But if they're too motivated by money and the things it can buy, they won't be sufficiently motivated to serve God and His kingdom. I'm pretty sure I don't need to tell you and go into detail about pastors and television evangelists in the last 60 years who have been notorious and embarrassing because of their love of money and their high-dollar lifestyles. I know you know those stories. I'm not going to tell them again. 12. It starts in verse 4 and goes through verse 5. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him with proper respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? This is usually thought of just strictly in terms of the behavior of the pastor's kids. But it's bigger than that, because it says he must manage his own family well and see that his children... There's more to managing your family well than just making sure your kids obey you, which is part of it, of course. Pastors should also manage their family finances well, and they should have a positive, good marriage. That's what we should be looking for. But you realize no one's perfect. No one's perfect, and neither are pastors. But a family bankruptcy in a history, suspicions of child abuse or neglect, pastors, teenagers getting in trouble with the police, those are the kind of things that Paul is saying. That's not a good sign. That's a red flag. You better pay attention to that, because if he can't do that, how can he do this? Shepherd the church. Now, please remember, because we think it all goes in one way, we're thinking the pastor who is so lenient with his kids that they run all over the church and break things and do all kinds of stuff, and when they get to be teenagers, they get arrested for possession of marijuana and speeding, and you know, that's the kind of pastor we think of. But there's two extremes, not just one. The first extreme is the one I'm just talking about, is the pastor who's inattentive to his family. He's not paying much attention to his family, or he's overly lenient with his kids, or he's distant from or too busy for his wife. But there's another extreme that looks completely different, that sometimes we think that's good pastoring or parenting. The other extreme is a pastor who is controlling and mean and harsh. And of course his kids obey him, because if they don't, they're going to get slapped upside the head. That's the other extreme, and that's not good either. Both extremes will destroy a pastor's ministry and whatever church that he leads. The 13th qualification mentioned by Paul is in verse 6. He must not be a recent convert. Or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. That always has caught me, like, really? What? It's always sounded a bit odd to me. But when you think about it, it makes sense, because what was it that the devil did that got God to cast him out of his presence? The devil became proud of himself and rebellious, and he had such an inflated view of himself that he thought he could challenge God. He thought he could take God's place. Well, a new convert might think, you know, I haven't been at this very long, man. I am the man. I got this all together, and these people have to do what I say. I've heard of a few. I've never known anybody who was a recent convert who became a pastor. Like, you know, they became a believer when they were 20 years old, and by the time they were 23, they had a pastor. They were pastor of a church. I've never known anybody like. I've heard of them, and I've heard some bad stories of how they had an inflated view of themselves. They began to think and act like little gods in their churches and communities, like little dictators, because they're so close to God that it's almost the same thing. You can hardly tell them apart. That's a disaster that absolutely has to be avoided at all costs. Well, I don't think any of the people in that has applied to be the pastor here is a recent convert. They all have years and years of Christian experience, so you don't have to worry about that. It's unusual that it happens at all. But in Ephesus, where new churches were being started, and hardly everybody was a new convert, it was a possibility. The last qualification that Paul mentions describes a similar kind of spiritual disaster as the previous one, but for a different kind of fault in the pastor. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Well, this I have seen. It happens sometimes that a pastor is able to put on enough of a show for his church when he's around them that they think he's a fine, godly man, when the truth is he's not all that at all. I swear, it sometimes seems like some of these pastors are able to cast some kind of spell over the church, and they can do whatever they want because these people are so convinced they're great men of God. And I don't know how they convince them of that. But in those kind of cases, a lot of the people on the outside of the church, they can see. They can see the hypocrisy and the immorality and the faults that the people in the church themselves can't even see, possibly because that pastor is putting on a show for the church, and out in the world, he's his real self. I knew of a church in upstate New York. You're not going to believe this, but I knew of a church in upstate New York who had a married pastor with three kids. In the church, as a member and a regular attender, was a teenager that he had gotten pregnant, and her baby, and his baby. I don't know how they let that happen. They didn't fire him. They didn't have a problem with it. But everybody in the community did, and no one would go to that church except the few people that were there. I don't know how that happens. Oddly enough, these kinds of pastors are often seen by people outside of the church for what they really are. They can see it. And that's exactly why, as a pastor search committee, when we look at references, we like to get references from people outside of the church. Because if he's respectable and he's a stand-up kind of guy, they're going to tell us good things about him. They're not going to say, oh man, you should see what he did last week over at, you know, wherever, at the bar. So that's what we're looking for. Christians or non-Christians? You should have a good reputation with non-Christians too, not just Christians. Well, without this kind of list of qualifications for pastors, churches might just pick the kinds of people the unchristian world would pick for some job. Think about who might get picked if you didn't have spiritual qualifications, moral qualifications. You might pick some slick-talking used car salesman. He just talked himself right into the pulpit, maybe. Or a church might call a sweet-talking man who's the most handsome man in town, is really good looking, and he just seems like our kind of guy. Or a church, on the other hand, might pick a very serious and somber man who never smiles or laughs because God's work is very serious. Or church, and churches love this kind of guy, might pick a workaholic man who spends 70 to 80 hours a week doing everything for the church, including being the janitor, as that funny part that we started with, which is not so funny because it happens. And he does that no matter the costs to his own health or the cost his family has to pay. So the New Testament shows us that we have to have the highest standards for pastors, while at the same time we have to make allowances for the fact that no one's perfect. Everybody's made mistakes. Even the best pastors make mistakes and have weaknesses. So we can't say, oh, we can't hire that person as a pastor because once he did that. Okay. That's not the way it works. I know of a pastor who was conducting a funeral for a well-loved member of the church and the community. A lot of people were there. And after the service, a smaller number of people, the family and closest friends, he led them to the cemetery where they were going to have a little ceremony there at the graveside. Once the casket was lowered into the ground, the pastor called everyone over to join him at the graveside to say their final goodbyes. And as he was backing up and motioning everybody to get closer so they could hear, he took one step too many and fell in the hole on top of the casket. Yeah. Whew. It gives me nightmares, and I wasn't there. Nobody's perfect. Everybody makes mistakes, but we should have the highest standards for anyone we would call as a pastor. Father, you know that we're seeking a new pastor. We have been for a while. And we pray that you help us keep these qualifications in mind, that we seek a godly man and not just anybody that drives by on the street. Help us avoid the problems that are hidden behind these requirements, because they all happen somewhere sometime. We don't want them to happen here. Guide us as a search committee and guide us as a church, that we'll see your will and we'll do it. It's in Jesus' name we pray.